We are on a tour of the bold, the brazen, the ingenious ways scientists are attacking this climate crisis. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Climate journalist Elizabeth Colbert lays it all out for us. We've dammed or diverted most of the world's major rivers. In our neck of the woods, evil, invasive Asian carp are in the crosshairs. And every hour and a half, Louisiana sheds another football field's worth of land. She's taken it all in, steadied herself on many a boat ride, getting an up-close look at our planet's crisis alongside the scientists who are presenting their fixes. What kind of extreme actions do you think must happen to mitigate the damage? What do you want to ask the climate author? 800-642-1234. Elizabeth Colbert is a longtime staff writer at The New Yorker. She won the Pulitzer Prize for her last book, The Sixth Extinction. Her new one is called Under a White Sky, The Nature of the Future. Elizabeth, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
Well, scientists the world over have no shortage of ideas on how to neutralize the effects of climate change. And the ones you highlight, the ones that we'll get into, they're a bit wacky. They're kind of unnerving. So how do you decide what to give credence to? How do you puzzle out what interventions are legitimate and deserve our attention?
Well, the way the book is organized, we start with interventions that are already underway. How's that? The book is really, the theme of the book is interventions to counteract, you know, previous interventions in the natural world. And the first place we go is to the electric fish barriers on the Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal. And that's already there. That's already up and pulsing electricity into the water. And then we sort of move from there to technologies that are, you know, in the sort of projects that are in the planning phase, all the way up to things that are sort of more speculative.
So when we hear that there's going to be a fix for climate change, or let's solve the climate crisis, it sounds really neat and tidy and compact and just kind of the way we humans like it to be. How dominant are we over the natural world?
Well, I offer a list at the beginning of the book, which list the many ways that we have become, you know, a dominant force, as people say, sort of vying, competing with the great forces of nature, you know, volcanism, tectonics. Our impacts are, you know, we are the dominant force on planet Earth right now. I don't think there's much doubt about that. We've completely altered the carbon cycle by burning a lot of fossil fuels, putting a lot of carbon dioxide into the air. We've completely altered the nitrogen cycle by pouring a lot of nitrogen, you know, fertilizers on our fields. We, as I say in the book, you know, we routinely cause earthquakes. So we have really, in some cases wittingly, in some cases unwittingly, become a dominant force.
One thing I appreciate in your book are the references to Rachel Carson, the author of the book Silent Spring from the early 60s. What did she grasp about our environment that we might maybe haven't come to terms with yet?
Well, the point of Rachel Carson's sort of signature work, Silent Spring, which the working title of which was The Control of Nature, is that, you know, humans, when you intervene in these complicated natural systems, you don't necessarily know what you're going to get. So that book is very much taking on this notion that you can, you know, douse the world in chemicals, synthetic chemicals, pesticides, herbicides, and not do a lot of damage. And Rachel Carson really woke the world up to the idea that you pour a lot of these chemicals onto the landscape and you're not just harming, you know, what you might call target insects or pests, but you're harming a lot of other forms of life as well. And that led to some very, very dramatic legal changes in the U.S. But one of the interesting things, and one of the points I make in the book, is Rachel Carson, interestingly, advocated, well, if you don't want to use chemicals, you should try to use what we call biocontrol. Use one insect, let's say, to get rid of another one insect predator to get rid of another one. And this idea of biocontrol has been tried many times and unfortunately also often with disastrous results.
Fails, so, yeah.
Yeah, the carp that are, you know, trying to get make their way into the Great Lakes, the Asian carp, they were brought over as agents of biocontrol, interestingly enough.
In the Deep South.
Yes, they had worked their way up from probably Arkansas, and probably there were other releases as well. But Arkansas was sort of, you know, ground zero for the state and federal governments imported these fish with the idea that they would, one species, Asian carp are actually four species, as your listeners probably know, one species was going to eat aquatic weeds, two species were supposed to help with this sort of nitrogen loading that comes off of sewage treatment plants. So they were supposed to do various forms of biocontrol. And to be honest, they probably are effective agents of biocontrol. They just also have a lot of other very unfortunate side effects.
We're talking with Elizabeth Colbert, who is a climate journalist, staff writer at The New Yorker. Her new book is called Under a White Sky. You can join in. Have you noticed evidence of climate change where you live? What steps have you taken to lessen your impact on the environment? What are you watching as scientists work on projects around the world? Join in with your questions, your insights, 800-642-1234. Elizabeth, let's look at the Asian carp problem here in the Midwest. We are in a battle against Asian carp. You document the ways we're trying to stop the Asian carp from dominating our river systems. Can you give us a snapshot of why they are so incredibly invasive, what they look like?
Sure. So Asian carp are, really large fish. Some of the species you can get fish up, you know, easily get fish up to 80 pounds. They're extremely, they look not unlike European carp, which are also invasive species, I should add, and which have been in American waterways for a century and a half now. So a lot of people assume, you know, that they were here, but they were not here. And they also probably did a lot of damage when they were introduced. They're very, very fertile, Asian carps, and they're very, very good. Two species, particular silver carp and bighead carp, they're extremely effective filter feeders, which means they take a lot of, you know, water into their mouths, and they have these combs basically behind their gills, and they just rake out whatever's in the water column. So they're very effective at that, and they basically, you know, eat every other species out of house and home, as it were, and just outcompete them. So there are stretches of the, you know, Mississippi River system, the whole system, which is obviously huge, where Asian carp make up more than 75% of the biomass in the river.
Mm, wow. Can you explain the electrification efforts to try to stop them from spreading further?
Sure. So the story sort of begins, you know, back at the turn of the 20th century when Chicago, needed to solve its solid waste problem. Chicago had grown up along the Chicago River, which flowed east into Lake Michigan, and Chicago was also taking its drinking water out of Lake Michigan, and it was pouring all of its waste, its animal waste from the stockyards and its human waste, into the Chicago River to get rid of it. And it was said the river was so thick with filth that a chicken could walk across it without getting her feet wet. So Chicago decided to try to solve this problem of drinking from the same source in which it was throwing its waste.
Heading into the Lake Michigan.
Yes, exactly. It was drinking from Lake Michigan, and it was pouring its waste into the Chicago River that was flowing into Lake Michigan. So I think everyone who's listening can understand this was kind of a bad idea, and you were getting a lot of waterborne disease. And so to solve this, the leaders, city leaders in Chicago decided to undertake this massive construction project, really the biggest of its kind at the time, to reverse the flow of the Chicago River so that instead of flowing into the lake, it would flow out of the lake and into the Mississippi drainage system. And this was a success on one level. There was sort of a facetious headline in the New York Times when the canal opened that reversed the river, and it said water in the Chicago River resembles liquid again, or something like that. So it solved one problem, but in the process, it connected the Great Lakes drainage basin and the Mississippi drainage basin. That was sort of one of the unintended consequences. They used to be separate. If you were a fish, you know, you couldn't swim out of one and into the other because they were just not connected. Now they are. And over the course of the 20th century, both the Mississippi system and particularly the Great Lakes system became highly invaded systems. So many invasive species, you know, wreaking havoc in different ways. And it was decided at around the turn of the 20th century, Congress decided, well, something needs to be done about the way species are migrating, especially invasive species, from one basin to another. And so they gave a directive to the Army Corps of Engineers to sort of close this connection. But of course, they couldn't really close it because you still had to have shipping and you still had to allow the Chicago's, you know, wastewater to flow.
You still had all this infrastructure there that was going on that you couldn't just shut down. I just want to pause there with author Elizabeth Colbert, who has been covering the environment for decades. You can join in. What do you want to know about the fixes that you've heard about? Can we engineer our way out of the climate crisis? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're looking at the climate crisis and how humanity is pursuing these bold experiments to solve or fix the problem we're in. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Climate journalist Elizabeth Colbert frames her book this way. It's about people trying to solve problems created by people trying to solve problems. Think electric Asian carp barriers that we've been talking about. Think buckets of coral sperm to revive coral reefs, dimming the sun through geoengineering. What fixes have you learned about or want to know about? 800-642-1234. Elizabeth Colbert's new book is called Under a White Sky, and she's with us for the hour. Let's bring in Michael now, joining us from Bear Valley. Hi, Michael. What would you like to add?
Hi, I had a question about the Asian carp. It seems like a tremendous amount of protein that might be going to waste, and I'm wondering if there's any research that's been done about converting it to pet food.
Michael, thank you. Elizabeth?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of killing of Asian carp, catching and of Asian carp that goes on to try to keep Asian carp from bumping up against these barriers, these electric barriers that are now in the Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal that are supposed to sort of repel species trying to cross that barrier between the two drainage basins. And I have, in fact, seen, you know, dog treats made out of Asian carp. A lot of them get ground up into, you know, fish fertilizer. But also, I should also add that people are, you know, the thinking is, one school of thought has it, you know, what's the best way to get rid of a species is to have humans get interested in it as a, you know, something to eat.
As a delicacy, right.
Exactly. And so I ate a lot of dishes that people have come up with to use Asian carp, and they were quite tasty, I have to say.
But it's bony, and so you have to do all this deboning, and that is an issue.
It's an issue. I mean, it's you know, these are sort of regional tastes. Americans don't like bony fish. In Asia, the fish are raised, you know, for consumption. People routinely eat Asian carp. A whole Asian carp is something you would have at a celebration. So those are just sort of, you know, national and regional taste difference. But Americans tend to, you know, like their fish boneless. And carp have these very thin sort of Y-shaped bones all through the fish that are very hard to debone. So they're very hard to debone.
All right. So getting back to these electric barriers and also these sound barriers, these disco barriers, what is working? What did you see out there on the water?
So to get back to the story of, you know, when Congress said to the Army Corps of Engineers, you know, do something to separate these waterways without actually these water systems without actually separating them, because as you pointed out, there's so much infrastructure now that depends on the way things are. What the Corps came up with were these electric barriers near Joliet. They pulse a lot of electricity into the water. And as I said, that's supposed to repel the fish. I've actually sort of taken a boat over the electric barriers, and there are huge signs warning you, don't go into the water. Don't even stick your hand in the water because you could end up electrocuted. And the question of whether these barriers have worked or not is a very open one. And so people don't want to rely on the barriers. They're thinking of new barriers, adding, as you said, bubbles and sound in sort of desperate effort to try to keep the fish out of the Great Lakes.
Let's bring in David now in Ironwood, Michigan. David, hi, go ahead.
Yeah, I have three ideas. The molten salt reactors can use up a lot of the waste that is, right now we're trying to find a place for. Regenerative farming, that's this feedlot farming and stuff is terrible. Go back to no-till farming, putting the cows back on pasture. I read someplace really reduces the amount of methane that actually gets in the atmosphere. And then this guy was talking about use pressurizing air. When there's too much electricity from the wind and the solar, you can use it to pressurize air. Then when you need extra power at nighttime, just run that pressurized air through a turbine. And the neat thing is, with a little extra energy, you can remove carbon dioxide. Because when you liquefy the air, things go into gases at different temperature, and you can separate the carbon out.
All right, David brings up several ideas here, Elizabeth. Molten salt. Salt reactors, no-till farming, and pressurizing air through turbines. What can you say to any of those?
Well, I mean, there are a lot of ideas out there and a lot of good ideas for, how we could try to mitigate, try to ameliorate the situation, have less of an impact on planet Earth. I can't speak to molten salt reactors. I think there are a lot of regenerative agricultural practices that would doubtless be, good for us to implement. In terms of, using pressurized air, that's basically using it as kind of a battery system. And the idea that you could remove the CO2 from the air in the process of doing that, I actually do have a chapter on this concept of carbon dioxide removal. It is eminently possible to remove carbon dioxide, from the air. We do it on submarines. The issue with that is that it takes energy. So, as long as you're getting your energy from fossil fuels, it kind of doesn't entirely make sense. But if we ever get to a point where all of our energy is coming from, carbon-free sources, then it might make sense to try to take some of the excess carbon that's already in the air and doing a lot of damage, out of the air.
We're talking with Elizabeth Colbert, climate journalist, staff writer at The New Yorker. Her book explores the projects, the interventions aimed at reversing the damage we've done to the natural world. Let's bring in Patrick now in Richland County. Hi, Patrick. What would you like to add?
Well, good morning. And I'd like to add, hopefully, a little bit of optimism to the situation. And that is, I know that the air quality improved over the cities because of the slowdown on the pandemic. But out here in Richland County in the country, it's been at least 2 decades, I think, since we've seen so many blue skies, really blue from horizon to horizon all day long. And that was because of a reduction in air travel. There's no question about it. I noticed the contrails are returning, but isn't this an indication if things slow up and not so much pollution, that nature can heal itself?
Patrick, thank you. Elizabeth, really blue skies, can nature heal itself?
Well, I think one of the themes of the book, I mean, certainly nature has tremendous capacity, such as it is. Now, one of the themes of the book is sort of, we're very much tied up in nature right now. There's nowhere that you can go, for example, where you don't find, traces of our presence. Those are either, carbon dioxide in the air, which we've changed very dramatically, little bits of plastic raining down all around the world, even very, very pristine, presumably very pristine parts of the world. you know, our impacts are everywhere. And yes, over time, I think, you know, given enough sort of undisturbed time, you know, carbon dioxide levels, for example, would eventually fall. But humans live on human timescales. And over human timescales, you know, even if you stopped emitting carbon tomorrow, which, you know, we're evidently not going to do, you would still have excess carbon dioxide in the air for centuries.
Pulitzer Prize winning climate journalist Elizabeth Colbert is our guide to the ways we're attempting to fix, meddle with Mother Nature in order to reverse the effects of climate change. What technology or combination of interventions do you hope can help solve the climate crisis we've caused? What do you want our government and industry to do? What hopes do you have for future policy? 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up with Elizabeth Colbert after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We are on a tour of the radical ways scientists have tried to tackle climate change through technology. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and our guide is Elizabeth Colbert. What a privilege to have her. Pulitzer Prize winner, longtime staff writer at The New Yorker, covering the environment for decades. And in her new book, Under a White Sky, she introduces us to a whole cast of engineers and biologists and atmospheric scientists, DNR types, who are all basically, you know, in the same boat, talking a big game about their work and trying to push interventions that might help save our planet. What technology do you wonder about? 800-642-1234. And Elizabeth Colbert is with us for the hour. Let's go to Daryl now in Couderay with a question. Hi, Daryl.
Good morning. Thank you for the program.
Sure.
My question is, what percent of the problem of climate change can be attributed to the human population? And has any study or research been done regarding human population impact changes that could be helpful to this worldwide problem?
Daryl, thank you. Yeah, what's our fault here in terms of overpopulation?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure how to answer the question, to be honest. You know, how much of climate change is attributable to human actions? This is a pretty key point. And I think the answer that you'd get from scientists is all of it. You know, if humans had not been pouring a lot of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, we would not be getting the climate change, that the warming that we're getting, 0% of it. So it's basically all human caused. Now, how to figure in, you know, population in that? Well, you know, the two functions of how much carbon you're getting into the air are, you know, how many people are there on the planet and how much carbon is each of us, you know, responsible for. And one of the complexities of the world as we live in it today is that a lot of countries where population is steady, or in Europe, in some European countries even falling, we're very, in the U.S., you know, relatively steady, you know, we're very high consumers. So we are putting a lot of carbon dioxide into the air. And then you have parts of the world where the population is still growing. And those tend to be very low consuming parts of the world. So, you know, human population is on some level, you know, key, but how much each person consumes and how much CO2 we throw into the air is even more important. How's that?
Let's travel now down the Mississippi, if you will, and go to Louisiana, the southernmost tip, Plaquemine Parish, where you spent some time as the researchers, the engineers, they're all trying to figure out how not to lose more land. What are they doing?
Yeah, so that's a very, you know, interesting story down the Mississippi. All of the Mississippi Delta, all of southern Louisiana, was formed, you know, over many millennia by the Mississippi overflowing its banks, basically, and dumping a lot of dumping the sediment that it has carried, you know, along its great, you know, back at the mouth of the river. And that is how the land was formed. The river would dump all the sediment. It would form what's called a delta lobe. That would become too steep. The river would switch course and form a new delta lobe. And that is southern Louisiana, all of this combination of delta lobes built over many thousands of years. And then starting in 1718, when the French founded New Orleans, they decided, well, they weren't going to allow the river to overflow its banks anymore or to flip around because New Orleans was there. So the river was going to have to be made to stay put. And there's been a 300-year effort to compel the river to stay put, which has, you know, been fairly successful, though we have had, you know, obviously major Mississippi floods in there. So successful, though, that we no longer get any sediment coming out of the river. It all just basically shoots into the Gulf of Mexico. So in Louisiana, southern Louisiana is sinking very rapidly. New Orleans is one of the fastest sinking places on earth because it doesn't get any of this sediment anymore. And now what engineers in Louisiana are trying to do and will do, it seems pretty clear that these projects will go forward, is trying to create controlled flooding, some form of controlled flooding through these huge structures called sediment diversions to counteract the effects of flood control. So to try to get some of that sediment out onto the land, it's obviously very complicated now because there's a lot of people living in southern Louisiana.
Yeah, you know, and I leave your Louisiana chapter after living there many years myself with this really unclear game plan and a very kind of uneasy feeling when you ask that question, how are 2 million people going to live in a region that was sinking into oblivion? Could you answer that any better after you finished your reporting?
Well, I think that this form of intervention, the sediment diversions, which interestingly enough are supposed to be financed, a few of them, out of the BP oil spill settlement fund that Louisiana got.
2010.
They will help. They will hopefully prolong the life of the Delta. Over the long haul, you know, as sea levels rise owing to climate change and as much of the state continues to sink, they're in a tough spot. And certain parts of the state, you know, I think it's clear, will, you know, people will move with their feet, as it were. And they already are. You know, there are parts of Louisiana, southern Louisiana, you can go to now. People wrote about them in the 19th century. They lived there. They had towns there. They just don't exist anymore. So that is going to increasingly happen. And, you know, one of the big question marks that hangs over it is the fate of New Orleans, a great, great American city.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Elizabeth Colbert, climate journalist, staff writer at The New Yorker, and her new book explores the projects, the interventions, all aimed at reversing the damage we've done to our natural world. You can join in 800-642-1234. Bill is with us from Madison this morning. Hi, Bill. What would you like to say?
Well, I chimed in here, and I thought this is very interesting stuff. My wife and I read Elizabeth's work all the time in the New Yorker, and I was delighted to hear that she was on there. A quick thought here: we're talking about conversation about climate change. Typically involves various technologies, as Elizabeth's been talking about. I've been thinking about the practice of ecological restoration in connection with my work at the University of Wisconsin Arboretum for quite some years now. And that thinking has led me to the idea that restoring ecosystems like the prairies here in the Midwest, which has been a central project for the Arboretum for a better part of a century now, has effects on the landscape but also on the people involved. And the people, of course, are the real problem here. And the idea here is that we can actually, the fundamental problem is human beings and their values. So what we need is to focus on the what I call the technologies of the imagination and value creation, which entails developing restoration as kind of a performing art, for example, And my wife has pointed out a scene in A Midsummer Night's Dream where the Queen of the Fairies points toward what basically amounts to climate change, and says the reason for it is because the King of the Fairies, with whom she's quarreling, has been interfering with the rituals that the fairies perform in order to maintain the order of nature. Hmm. And I think that probably reflects ancient human wisdom about human relations with the environment.
Oh, Bill, thank you so much for sharing that. Elizabeth, what do you see of the connectedness to our human values?
You know, I think Bill is dead on, and a lot of the, you know, situation that we're in has that of having become such a dominant force on the planet reflects, you know, a certain human impulses and talents. You know, we're just extremely talented in terms of changing our environment, changing the world. That turns out to be one of our great, great talents as a species. And the question of whether we have other hidden talents, as it were, to allow us to now undo the forms of intervention that we don't care for, we don't care for the results of, you know, that's the big question. That's really the big question for our century, I believe. And the people, you know, the projects that I went to visit were proposing certain answers. You can as a reader decide, you know, this is crazy, or you can decide this is the way to go. Those are both, I think, very valid reactions to the book. But one point that the book makes, I think, pretty strongly, and I like to think convincingly, is in a lot of cases, unfortunately, there just is no going back, at least not on a human timescale. You know, we mentioned the example of carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide just hangs around in the air for a long time. So, you know, once you move in one direction, it's just really hard to move in the other direction.
Climate journalist and author Elizabeth Colbert explaining climate change through the eyes of scientists who are working on these fixes every day. What policies do you hope President Biden and Congress will act on? What measures should be taken? And how should we measure our progress in this pursuit in trying to resolve the climate? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Elizabeth Colbert here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with Elizabeth Colbert of The New Yorker. Her new book looks at the climate crisis through the scientists who are racing toward this patchwork of solutions, if you will. And her sources pointed out scientists can only make recommendations. Implementation is a political decision. And she writes, you might hope that such a decision would be made equitably with respect to those alive today and to future generations, both human and non-human. But she says, let's just say that record here isn't strong. And Elizabeth Colbert is with us for 10 more minutes. Let's bring in Jess now in Milwaukee. Hi, Jess.
Hi, how you doing today?
Doing well. What would you like to add?
Well, my idea has been this for a while, and I never understood why we haven't done this, is that in human population areas, we have water treatment plants, okay? And we treat the manure, and we treat the waste and so on, and we actually create fertilizer out of human waste and so on. Why can't we do that with these large corporate farms when it comes to cattle, pigs, chickens, and so on? Not for every farm, but the fact is in a collective area. So we in Milwaukee, we have Jones Island that treats our water system here. Why can't we do that with the animals and help reduce the nitrates and other problems that large farming areas produce?
Jess, thank you. Any insights there, Elizabeth, on what large-scale farm operations, these CAFOs, could do in order to pull out those nitrates and use them?
I'm afraid we're beyond my level of knowledge here. I have to confess. I mean, yes, there's a lot of usable fertilizer in animal waste. Absolutely. I live in a part of the world where, you know, people still spread manure on the fields. These are pretty small scale operations, though. I live in New England. And what they're doing with the CAFO waste, I don't know, but it is, as your listener suggests, you know, a huge problem, and to use a bad pun, a wasted opportunity. And there's a lot of it that's running off into our waterways, causing, you know, nitrogen loading that's unhealthy for the ecosystem.
Let's look at politics here for a moment with the Biden administration in the White House. What are you seeing there in terms of climate change policy? And do you see action yet out of the Biden administration?
Well, it's really early. How's that? They have the president, you know, has come in. I think everyone who, you know, follows climate policy would say quite strong, with a whole slew of executive orders that in some cases overturned Trump era policies that were really designed to, you know, sort of astonishingly promote fossil fuel use and exploration. And also has gone beyond that. And, you know, for example, one executive order directed federal agencies to try to use their purchasing power, which is, you know, very high. The federal government simply buys a lot of goods and a lot of energy to foster clean energy and electric vehicles. So I think that they've taken a lot of very strong stands and appointed very good people to key positions. Now, you know, that being said, I think everyone also who, you know, looks at this issue would say it's very difficult to move things where we need to get in terms of emissions simply through executive action. You really need some kind of legislation. And unfortunately, this country has not seen a piece of major environmental legislation since 1990, so over 30 years now. And it's very hard to solve new problems with old laws, it turns out.
When you talk emissions, we saw at the end of last month General Motors announcing that they will only sell zero emission vehicles by 2035, part of a bigger plan to be carbon neutral by 2040. How significant is that move?
Well, if, you know, realized, it's very significant. I think that that announcement by GM, you know, is potentially extremely significant, signaling a whole new era, that we are going to move into an era of electric cars. And the reason that that is key is because, you know, if you have an internal combustion engine, you are committed to carbon emissions. You've got to put gasoline or diesel fuel in that car. If you convert to an electric fleet, then you can, the thinking goes, you can decarbonize your electricity sector and you can have cars that are essentially running on carbon-free energy. And that is huge. Transportation at this point is our single biggest source of greenhouse gases in this country right now, even having overtaken the power sector. So it is potentially a huge, huge move. We unfortunately have seen the car companies, you know, waffle over the years, make big statements, retreat from them. So we'll see. We'll see where this goes.
It's interesting. I mean, can it sway the industry? Will others follow suit? Is certainly something to wonder about.
You know, I think it really gets down at the end of the day, you know, the car companies are going to respond to, you know, legal pressure and market pressure. And if people buy electric cars, if everyone decides that's the way the world is going. I have a car that's, you know, part electric, runs the first 30 miles or so on electricity. And it's actually a lot of fun. Electric cars actually, you know, I think a lot of people would argue drive better than gasoline powered cars. So if people decide this is the future, then GM will stick to this plan. And if they don't, if they reject electric cars, you know, it won't, unfortunately. So that's the situation that we're in.
Market forces dictating there. Talking with Elizabeth Colbert, climate journalist, staff writer at The New Yorker. Steve is with us now from Lake Geneva. Hi, Steve. What would you like to say about vehicles?
Yes. Hi there, Elizabeth. And my comment is that we now understand that one of the most effective ways at addressing our myriad environmental crises is to to convince people that buying, going out and purchasing large, heavy vehicles, whether they're gas-powered or electric, is extremely environmentally damaging and destructive. Right now, we know that there's a scramble to search for and mine mineral and metal-rich deposits undersea, and there could be all kinds of incredibly destructive environmental impacts associated with that. We know the focus should be on walking, biking, micro-mobility options, and high-quality public transport. GM's scheduled release of an all-electric Hummer really must not be representative of the future of mobility. It's just the wrong path forward. And
Steve, thank you. We're a bit short on time there. Elizabeth, any thoughts on what Steve has to say?
I totally agree with Steve. We need to get all of the arrows pointing in the right way. And an electric Hummer, while better than a gas-powered or diesel-powered Hummer, is still a Hummer and still a waste of resources. Absolutely.
When you look forward, future generations, the young people out there who are really trying to compel environmental problems to seek action, does that help? What do you see out of the new generation?
Well, I certainly think that the more focus that we have on these issues and the more, you know, political will we have to try to tackle them, the better. So I really, you know, applaud young people and urge them to be politically engaged, because these issues of how the world, what the world, and I don't just mean the human world, the human and the non-human world is going to look like, you know, a few decades from now at the end of the century, is very much an open question. We are deciding it, and it will have ramifications, you know, that will last for all intents and purposes forever.
You know, we only have a few seconds left, but will technology save us? Is that one of our talents, or will the technology we create hurt us in the end?
Well, that is the question at the heart of the book, and it's a question that I'm afraid I personally can't answer and don't answer in the book, but that is the question, it seems to me.
So as we start to wrap up here, what can we do individually in our own lives to make a difference?
Well, I think the point that Steve made is really crucial. I mean, we need to examine our resource use, you know, on all levels. And probably we just need to use a lot less resources, especially as Americans. There's a whole world out there of people competing for resources, and we use, you know, way, way, way more than our fair share. And so any way in which we can try to reduce our resource use would be a step in the right direction.
Elizabeth, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Elizabeth Colbert is a climate journalist, staff writer at The New Yorker. She won the Pulitzer Prize for her last book, The Sixth Extinction, and her new one is called Under a White Sky, The Nature of the Future. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.